Well, hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and I want to extend a warm welcome to everyone who is joining us here for another Happy Hour with Dr. T special event. Each week, we get together with amazing guests for conversations to inspire you and help you grow on Tuesday night. And then on Thursday night, we have special events. And with that, tonight is the next episode in our 8-part special event in our Happy Hour with Dr. T series with Brad Cummings. As you know, the last several years we've hosted special events for deeper Bible study on Thursday nights, and they are available for you to view at drtenpenny.com. Hover over the podcast tab and you will see where it says special events, and all of them are listed there. You can watch this tonight here and all of our live broadcasts on Thursday at 6 o'clock, and then it will also be aired at 7 o'clock on Friday nights with His Glory ME. For those joining us for the first time, let me introduce to you my dear friend and powerful prayer warrior, Brad Cummings. The former pastor for 20 years, Brad is the CEO of Shiloh Road Publishers, the publisher and general editor of The Founders Bible. He has co-authored and published the #1 New York Times bestseller, The Shack, which sold more than 22 million copies and has been translated into 40 different languages. He is producer of The Shack movie, released in 2017, and is currently working with Lionsgate and Amazon to turn The Shack into a TV series. Brad is an author, screenwriter, producer, publisher, editor, conference speaker, frequent podcast guest, and most importantly, one of my very best friends in the whole wide world. He runs Windblown Media and is working on several books and has several movies in development. This is an 8-part series that we've been doing through since the beginning of the year. And if you haven't seen the series, you can go to drtenpenny.com, hover over the podcast tab, and you will see a link that says Happy Hours Series. If you go to that link, look for the name of this series, which is All Things That Matter, and you will find the past episodes. In part one, we talked about what does it mean to be saved? Part two, the difference between the old and the new covenant, and what it means to be a believer. Part three, we talked about God's outrageous love for humanity. Part four, we talked about hell, the lake of fire, and the law of Jubilee, and what the fire really means. And if you've missed any of those, please go to and rewatch them. If you've seen them before, go back and watch them again. This time, make sure you bring a tablet and a pen, because you will definitely want to take notes. Tonight is episode 5, and we're going to discuss the great mistake when Israel asked for a king. So Brad, I'm so excited to get into part 5 of what we've been talking about. All the things we've been talking about in the last few weeks, I have felt they have been very life-changing. So I'm looking forward as we continue on our next fireside chat.
Awesome. Yeah, I mean, I think for a lot of people, they're a different paradigm shift. I think one of the most important things is to understand is that at the end of the day, God is love. And so everything that flows from him flows from that nature. Like even his judgments, that flows from a heart of love. And when we understand the big vow that he promised, he really did promise by his own self that he's going to save all of humanity. I think most of us don't believe that. And I think one of the biggest problems behind that is because we don't see justice done on earth, and we don't see that the bad guys actually get their comeuppance. I think a lot of people like the idea of hell, because it makes it feel like somebody's at least going to get what they deserve. And I don't think we think that through. It's like, I don't want to go there and I don't want to throw someone in there. But I think because the world right now does not see justice done, I think a lot of us have an unresolved element with that. And so the idea that somehow the scales will be balanced in eternity, I think most of us like that idea. And I think the good news is God is an impartial judge. Everyone is going to have to give an account for what they've done. You know, when you're focused on pursuing God and loving God, that's not a scary thought, because it's like, hey, I can't wait to kind of be in front of him. If you're kind of doing your own deal, then the idea that there's accountability and consequences, that can be a little scary for folks. And so I think when we look at this, it's like a lot of times we don't see the big picture of what God is doing. So it's kind of hard when, and especially in a world of today, when everything kind of seems to be being upended and we're not sure what's going on. We don't know if we can trust the government, stuff like that. I think one of the most important things to do is to try to see the big picture. And I think the big picture is God is wanting to redeem all of mankind, and that he's also wanting to fill the whole earth with his glory. And so God is at work, and he promised to do something all by himself. And I know we're involved, but the truth is my confidence isn't in us, nor is my fear that the will of man can stop God from accomplishing what he wants to do. My confidence is the fact that God promised he will do a certain thing, and that's to fill the whole earth with his glory. He's somehow going to make all of this happen without violating a single will in the process, which I find is astounding.
Yeah, and I don't know that people find that comforting. You know, I mean, yes, we want to believe that God has mercy and God forgives, but you know, how many times have we said, well, if they don't get what's coming to them in this life, they will in the next. I mean, that's part of our language.
And I think the reality is that God, everyone is going to face judgment. Salvation comes as a gift to us. That's the, you know, our the new covenant is that God is going to do a work in me, and I basically receive and respond to that. It's not I'm going to somehow going to please God and I'm going to be obedient to everything, because I think most of us are always trying to recommit ourselves unto the things of God. And I think that's a good intention, but I don't know about you. I find that there's stuff in me that I still can't overcome without God's help. And so I think the whole Christian life is how do I allow God to be at work in me to bring me to the place of what he wants to do in me? And when we look at the reality of the ju of judgment and how God has worked in the lives of his people, I think we can learn some incredible lessons of how we go about partnering with that. Because you know, the idea that, you know, God's going to save everybody, I think that's fantastic. I do know that we do have this sense of there's an injustice in the world and we want to see those scales balance, correct?
I think that we do, and I think it's because it's probably just human nature, you know, that if you punch me, if I can't punch you back, I want somebody to punch you, you know, that sort of thing.
I think one of the biggest problems we have is because we don't actually understand how the law works. We don't really see biblical justice done. Like, we know we're supposed to forgive, right? Like, if someone's hurt me, I'm supposed to forgive them. But the truth is the law demands that they make restitution for the victim. And we don't see anybody doing that. So what we're doing for the wrongdoers is everyone wants amnesty. Like, hey, it didn't matter. Just, you know, my bad, you know, gee, I'm sorry, but nobody actually sets wrong things right. And I think that's where the objection is in the human heart, because we know somehow that's not okay. You know, unless the victim is taken care of, justice isn't done. And I think one of the things that we don't recognize is that God doesn't wink at anybody's sin. He doesn't just give anyone a pass. He's going to deal with all of us, because if we're behaving in a way that's damaging to others, God really is at some juncture going to step in and do something about it.
Well, you know, this kind of goes, you know, we want to talk tonight a little bit about Israel's mistake in making a king, but this goes all the way back to Moses and what got him bunched in terms of God's justice. And I remember when I read this section, I contacted you and said, well, gosh, all he did was like, you know, strike a rock. I mean, and now all these years of putting up with these whiny Israelites, you know, whining and moseying through a little tiny piece of land and putting up with them and putting up with them. And now God's going to say, not forgive him for that and provide justice for that. What is it that got him benched and barred from entering into the promised land? And do you think that was kind of harsh on God's side?
Yeah, I mean, when we first read it, here's Moses, the guy that has led them all out of Egypt. You know, he helped bring down the world empire of the day. God kind of, you know, dethroned all of their gods and he set his people free. And then it's Moses's job to bring the people into the wilderness to meet with God so that God could speak to them directly. they reject that, and then for 40 years they're wandering in the wilderness, and
Yeah.
Moses is the leader, and he's having to put up with a constant murmuring and whining, and they kind of said, "Why did God bring us out here? We should have just stayed in Egypt. He's out here to kill us." And I think a lot of times when we're wandering in our wilderness, as opposed to entering into our promises and destiny, it can feel like that. So in this moment where after 40 years of people have wandered, the older generation that refused to enter in has died off. We now have a younger generation that is in the same position where they're out of food and out of water, and they're frightened. And they say, "Moses, help." And God says, "Moses, I want you to speak to the rock." They're right back at the same rock that he struck the first time, and water came out to basically provide for about 2 million people. That's a big miracle. That's not a small thing. And so we're back in the same place with this, with the younger generation. They're about to enter in. And Moses is kind of just, I mean, he's fit to be tied. He's so exhausted from all of their murmuring and complaining. In that moment, he strikes the rock as opposed to speaks to it. And it's a huge moment, because what's needed is the younger generation's afraid. They don't think they're able, that they don't know if God's going to provide. And the most important thing they could have is they need to have a true understanding of who God is, and that he's with them, and that he's for them. And sadly, in a moment of impatience, Moses demonstrated God as angry and reluctant to provide. And that was probably the worst thing that he could have done to help people enter into the promises. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
I
it
think
does.
if we see God as angry at us, we won't really come to him. If we see him as reluctant to providing for genuine needs, we won't know who to turn to. And so we'll probably turn to our own self, and we're not going to be capable of doing this. So it does feel like, wow, God, you benched Moses, your star player, and right when they need him most, you sat him down. And I think the reality is it's really important how leaders demonstrate and present who God is. If we do that wrong, we're going to impair the people's capacity to walk in obedience and understand the promises and to be able to enter in and fulfill them. And it's interesting when you think of, why did God have them wander for 40 years in the wilderness? This was that verse at the end of it, that when Moses is sort of, he is retelling them their whole history. He's sort of surprised at this thing, that after 40 years, in Deuteronomy 29:4, he says, "Yet to this day, God has not yet given you a heart to know, nor eyes to see, nor ears to hear." And I kind of stopped and I went, I've never seen that before. I went, I think that's the purpose of the wilderness, that somewhere in our wandering and our need to depend upon God, we're supposed to gain a heart to know him, eyes to see him, and ears to be able to hear him. Because the reason we're in the wilderness is because we rejected hearing his voice in the first place. I think that's probably the most essential skill for anybody to develop in their walk with Jesus, is to be able to hear him and respond to him. Because I don't think we're meant to do this without him.
Is there, is there, and you and I have had lots of conversations about this. I mean, is there a way to develop better ears, better eyes to see, better ears to hear, and a bigger, more sensitive heart to know? I mean, because I know, for myself, I mean, this has been a grueling, 2024 has been a grueling year for me. I mean, probably, honestly, if I look back, probably the worst year of my life, between the stroke and, financial struggles and, all sorts of things, and so many times I would cry out to the Lord and get crickets back. And so, and I'm sure that I'm not unique in that position, and that's why I'm bringing it up here, is for, to talk about this a little bit and say, maybe the crickets really aren't crickets. Maybe you aren't hearing. I don't really know. I know.
I think, remember we talked a little bit about the difference between the soul and spirit. I think a lot of people are stuck, honestly, in their soul. They're functioning under their own capacity. That's my mind, my will, and my emotions, and I'm trying to figure it all out. But we really need to understand the realm of the spirit, and that's the thing that God causes us to be born again on the inside. My spirit comes alive. I've got to spend time seeking God and understanding that realm of the spirit for my spiritual ears to open up. And I think for a lot of people, it's like it's still sort of a mental cerebration thing. And I think one of the things that God does do that we kind of forsake is that He does lay out that, hey, I want you to look at the dynamics in your life. You know, there's blessings for obedience, there's cursings for disobedience, there's dynamics. And so when things are not going well, I do think it's an invitation to kind of say, hey, God, search me, try me, see if there be any wicked way in me. You know, renew a right spirit within me and cast me not away from your presence. And I don't think it's about performance Christianity that if I just do all the right things, I get all the right goodies. But I do think that God is at work in me trying to transform me. And so a lot of times we do need to kind of present ourselves to God and kind of say, hey, do you have issue with me? And then hopefully have the honesty to then deal with it as opposed to being afraid and we hide. At the beginning, we talked about how we got sin wrong. Because if we really knew the heart of God in those moments where things are not going well, we would be running to Him as opposed to running from Him. And as opposed to hiding in our shame, we would be able to say, God, guess what? There's something wrong inside. I need your help. Could you fix it? I don't think it's our trying to fix ourselves all the time. I mean, I think most time Christianity is presented as a self-improvement program. And I think it's nice, but I'm 58, I've realized I've been walking with him since I was six. The self-improvement thing doesn't really work. It's a nice effort, but it's like I'm really changed by the things that God has dealt with me on. And I know that at times when I've been disciplined, I don't enjoy it, but it is evidence that I am his son. And I think that when we don't fight against that and we embrace that, then we start to see things really change. I mean, I would love it if it was all rainbows and puppy dogs. It's not. And the reality is if I am walking with God, to whom much is given, much is required, and I think at times we don't recognize his disciplining me is part of his loving and changing me. He doesn't want me to stay where I'm at, and he doesn't want me to go after the things that are not him. And I think when he starts to change my heart and it starts to turn, that's really where I do recognize my eyes are beginning to see and my ears are beginning to hear, and my heart in its kind of contrition and surrender to him, it is responding. And I think that's how that develops. But I don't think it's a magic wand. It's like I can't just go like I'm gonna flick a switch and here's God speaking to me, and then I'll switch it off or I'll switch it on. You know, the word to hear and to obey are the same word in Hebrew.
Oh, wow.
And you kind of go like, if you don't have a heart to obey, God in mercy is going to be quiet. Because the more he speaks, the more you're going to be judged by. You know, it's like according to the light that we've received, that's our responsibility. So when God knows that you're really not in a place of you want to do what you want to do, as opposed to I'm showing up as a servant to obey him, he goes quiet. It's not because he doesn't love us, it's because he knows I'm not really purposing to obey. So one of the first things I do is like, hey God, the blank contract. I have no idea what it says, but I'm going to sign it anyway because I know that you love me. And that sense of God's love is he has my highest good at his heart intention and desire for me. I may look at that and want to negotiate, but I've realized that usually is part of where my hearing starts to wane. You know, like when God asks me to do something, I want my heart instinct to say, yes, sir. Because what he's wanting is he's wanting to bring me into a place of agreement with him. Not just he wants little good soldiers that obey him. It's like, no, he wants sons that understand him and function like him, think like him, and learn to love like him. And I think that's a whole lifelong process. So I don't think it's microwaved. I wish it was faster, But I think if our response to him was more in that place of surrender, that we have to put to death that old self in us. That's the guy that's not in agreement with God. That's the one that's corrupted with sin. That's all the process of I die daily, to the things that I want to do, and I'm saying yes to the things he wants me to do. And it is a process of discerning. That's why I don't think we're supposed to do this by ourselves. You need other voices in your life to help give you commentary on what they're seeing and observing. Does that make sense at all?
That's really good. And that's really interesting about having other people's feedbacks. Does that kind of lead to the hard hearts and the lack of ears to hear and the lack of eyes to see why that sometimes you just don't even think there's a God out there, and why Israel decided that they wanted to have a king because they wanted to have a physical, tangible human that they could touch and talk to, because
Well,
they didn't know that the real king was God.
it's interesting. If I was to ask you this question, what was the greatest tragedy ever experienced in the Old Testament? What would come to mind for you? Or what would you think is the worst thing that could ever happened?
Oh gosh, there's so much, there's
No, I know
so
it's not an easy question. I didn't prep you for it. It's not a Sunday school moment where you get a star in your chart if you get the right answer. For me, I look at the most crucial, most devastating moment that put everything else wrong in motion is the day in which the people of God lost the presence of God with them. And it's going to a time in the book of Samuel with Eli, and it says they have the Ark of God with them. But because Eli had sort of become, it's like he's old, he's kind of blind, can't see much, and his sons, as the priests, they're pretty reprobate. They're sleeping with the women who are dedicated to the service of the temple, the tabernacle. And you're just going like, okay, that's happening today. And what's going on? When you see the corruption of the priesthood, and you see the people who are supposed to be representing God behaving in ways that are absolutely terrible. They went out to fight with the Philistines one time, and when they would take the ark, it was sort of like, this is our, this destroys all of our enemies, the presence of God. Well, in this battle, they went out and they lost the ark. The ark was captured by the Philistines, and Phinehas was warned because he had not disciplined his sons and dealt with them, that they both would die on the same day. And they did in that battle. In that battle, 30,000 foot soldiers of Israel died. And Hophni and Phinehas, the two, kind of priestly leaders, they died in the battle. And when Eli was told about it, he fell backward and broke his neck. He was so big and fat and, and fell back. He broke his neck. And Phinehas's daughter was pregnant at the time. She was in labor and she gave birth to a baby, but she died in labor, and the baby's name was Ichabod, which is the glory has departed. And it's really that pivotal moment where Israel, because of their lack of responding to God, they lost the presence of God, and God kind of says, I'm out of here. And the Philistines take him and they put him in the temple of Dagon. And every morning they find out that their God, who's this big fish God-looking thing, he's fallen down before the ark. And they finally realize this God, and finally Dagon falls down and he breaks all apart. So God all by himself in the camp of the enemy is dethroning their gods. But why is that the worst thing that could happen? Well, for the next generation, the people lived without the presence of God in their midst. That was the only thing that defined who Israel was. Like in the wilderness, it was God was a pillar of fire at night and a pillar of cloud during the day. And whenever the cloud moved, that's when they moved. That's how they went through the wilderness. The only thing that defined them from all the other nations of the world was that they were God's people and God was there in their midst. He was present with them. So what happens when the presence of God, the manifest presence of God, is gone for a generation? And then you realize Eli, his sons were terrible. So Samuel gets raised up and he's a wonderful guy. But then Samuel does not really have very good sons. So at the end of his life, they're going like, we don't want to go back to these bad leaders. And so at that moment, they kind of said, hey, we want a king. And why is that so bad? Well, because they didn't recognize that God really was the one who was meant to rule over them. What you see in the book of Judges, I know a lot of people don't do their devotions there, but you see this whole history of the people of God. They kind of forsake God and forget God, and they wander over and they start following the other gods. And then, as a form of judgment, God allows them to fall into captivity and be ruled over by those people. And he warned them throughout the book of Judges. It's like, hey, if you forsake me, this is what's going to happen. You'll end up serving, you'll be the servants of those people. They will rule over you. And so God basically says, you know, if you want to worship something else, go right ahead, but it will enslave you. And so you see this whole cycle is the people get put into captivity because they've forsaken God. When they finally realize it, they start to repent and cry out. And after they've repented, God raises up a deliverer that then overthrows the enemy and brings them back. And then they're good for a little while, but then they do it again. You see, there were six different times that the nation of Israel went into captivity because of forsaking God and not relating to him like that. And I look at that, and I'm going like, that's a picture of what's happened throughout history of the people of God. God actually is a good father, and if like we stray in disobedience, he actually allows us to experience the consequences of that. And I don't think we like that. That's why we end up going like, oh, you know, God doesn't love us. And it's like, well, no, he does, but he is disciplining you at times because you've strayed and you've wandered away and you're worshiping something else. And I don't think it's the Zeus God who's throwing lightning bolts at us. I think it's God saying, hey, I'm a jealous God, and that's a good jealousy. He's a consuming fire. That's a good cleansing, corrective fire. And he's basically saying, don't have other gods before me. Why? Because they will enslave you. And I don't think we see it that way. We go like, well, but I like that. But then we don't, and then it promises something that it doesn't deliver. And then we go, oh, but I don't like that. And we don't do the math.
I guess that's right.
You know?
Well, I think this is a good spot, not doing the math and not really understanding when you say other gods, it doesn't have to mean a deity. It could be your work, it could be a relationship, it could be your fun time, you know, whatever it is that you spend time and you kind of worship or spend more time with than the living God. So we're going to take a really quick break right here today. This is a good time to take a break. We're talking with Brad Cummings, the publisher and general editor of the Founders Bible. This is part five of an eight-part series, and tonight we're talking about when Israel asked for a king. We're going to take this really quick break. We will be right back.
Zeolite is a detox spray. We work specifically with a company called Touchstone Essentials. They are an incredible company. We've been working with them now for several years. And zeolite is a mineral that goes through your body like a one-way basket. It will clean out heavy metals such as arsenic and mercury, aluminum, cadmium, and it hooks onto those metals from a one-way perspective. So once it's bound, it goes out through your urine or your stools and doesn't get redeposited in other places. Everybody needs to have a detox product in their life, and this one is so easy to use and it's so safe. You can take it when you're pregnant, you can take it when you're nursing, you can give it to little children, you can even give it to infants, and quite frankly, I give it to my dog. I actually put a little bit of the zeolite in his water because until we all stop living in a toxic world, we all need to get some of those extra toxicities out. The heavy metals, the persistent organic pollutants, the things that are floating through the air, the different things that we come in touch within our environment. And we are a big fan of zeolite from Touchstone Essentials. We've been a big, big, big fan of their products for several years.
Go to drtenpenny.com/detox to get your first bottle of zeolite spray for $50 off.
There are an awful lot of people that are affiliates for Mike Lindell because we all really appreciate what he does for this country. We appreciate the hard work that he does, and we appreciate his products. He has more than 200 products in his store, everything from pillowcases and comforters to doggy beds and to wonderful slippers and bathrobes. There's something for everybody and something for everybody in each age group. I mean, one of the things that I really like a lot are the pillowcases, the children's Bible story pillowcases that I just think are such a great way when you tuck your child into bed at night to use these pillowcases that they come from his store to start to tell the story about Adam and Eve and Noah and the Ark and different things. And they're colorful and they're really pretty. So from children all the way up to your gentlemen that want to have like nice slippers or to your dog, the doggy beds and things are just wonderful. So my pillow is a great place to shop for just about anything that you want. And if you use our affiliate code DRT, that helps us, that can benefit us, that helps Mike Lindell, and you'll get a great product for anybody that you're shopping for.
Well, welcome back, everyone. You know, Brad, in keeping with tonight's topic, what did God warn them would happen in choosing to be ruled over by an earthly king? And despite the warning, why do you think Israel asked for a king?
When they asked for a king, Samuel felt like, hey, they're rejecting me. And he went to talk to God about it. And God said, Samuel, they're not rejecting you. They're actually rejecting me. Let them know that if they ask for a king, he's going to take their sons and put them in the army. He's going to take their daughters and put them. It's like, in effect, he's going to take from your flocks, your herds, and your families. You're going to be enslaved to serve that guy. He's going to take a tenth of all your stuff. And it's like, if you want a king other than me, you are going to be enslaved by him. That was what they warned. And the truth is they kind of went, yeah, okay, but we still want a king. And I think the reason was is because they had for a generation, they had become accustomed to God wasn't there in their midst in such a way that they could see and know. And so it's like the idea of him actually ruling over them, that didn't really make sense. They wanted someone with, you know, skin on. They wanted a champion that would kick their enemies' butts. It's like they wanted someone who would defend them and fight for them and not require them to walk in obedience to do so. Because when God was the one who was ruling over them, he allowed the enemies to rule over them when they walked away in disobedience. They were tired of that. So I think the reason they really asked for a king is like, we don't like this stringent accountability with the living God. We would sooner be like the other king, other nations. We want a champion for ourselves. And so they got Saul. And God picked the best, the brightest. I mean, Saul was head and shoulders above everyone else. He was like the biggest, tallest, strongest, best looking quarterback guy in the world. And they picked him, and he wasn't a bad pick, and God was happy to pick him. It's like, you want a champion? Here you go. But here's what's going to happen. And the problem is, you know, if you look at the life of Saul had an encounter with the Holy Spirit in the Old Testament. He was like the prophets and prophesied. So it's like the anointing of God was on him. But Saul was, you know, when he was small in his own eyes, he walked well. When he started to become, you know, the champion, it's like he started to impose things on the people, and it wasn't good. And then when it came time to fight the enemies, you know, we got David and Goliath. You got Goliath there, and Saul's, you know, everyone's too intimidated to go to war. And so you're just going like, what's going on there? And in the entire time of Saul's kingship, he never sought the Ark of God. It's like they had lost it to the Philistines, but he never sought to regain the presence of God. And I think that's a sense of where his heart was at.
And he wasn't really a very confident guy. He was always asking for other people's opinions. And what do you think about this? And what do you think about that? I mean, he didn't have great in my opinion, from reading, you know, through that section of the Bible, that he didn't have great leadership skills. And so he didn't, and he didn't turn to the Lord either. Remember when Samuel first talked to him, it was a couple of years before he said yes. He had to think about it and go about his different, you know, doing whatever he was doing. He's like, I don't know. I don't know about this king thing.
I think Saul's a picture of a guy stuck in his soul that's not pursuing God. So when you look at the contrast between Saul and David, David, is this little shepherd boy out in the back, and he's worshiping God, and he's fearless, able to fight off lions, and he's protecting the sheep. It's like he ends up having a heart that God is looking for, and it's a picture of the heart of Jesus, frankly. David's not sinless, and so there's no analogy that ever works perfectly, but David has a heart to go after God. And David is this, it's like when David is chosen to be king, Samuel anoints him to be king. Saul's still the king, and he goes to Jesse, he says, "Bring me all your boys." And Jesse does, but he leaves David out. And so Samuel looks through all the top 10 quarterbacks of Jesse's household, and it's like they're all fantastic, but nope. And he says, "Do you have any more sons?" Well, David was most likely the product of an adulterous affair. He was born, he was not a legitimate son, so that's why Jesse didn't just say, "Well, the last guy has to look after the herd." It's like the prophet comes to ask him to bring all of his boys. And it's like he leaves David out. Why? Well, conveniently, because he's kind of hiding the reality of who David is. So David is, chosen, but he's not seen as a legitimate, son of Jesse. Well, look at Jesus. Jesus was born of a virgin, and nobody believed, "Oh yeah, that's exactly what happened, right, Mary?" Nobody believed that it was a miraculous virgin birth. They all kind of went, "Doesn't happen that way." So Jesus grew up under the whole specter of illegitimacy. And so you do have a type between David and Jesus that's there. It's pretty profound. But David has a heart after God, and David isn't sinless, but he's in pursuit of God. He says, "One thing I desire, one thing I seek, that I may dwell in your house, O God, and gaze at your beauty." That's kind of interesting in the Old Testament, don't you think?
It is, and you're right. I mean, one of the things about David that, is at least for me, the symbolism of David is that God takes imperfect people, really imperfect people. I mean, with all he was a murderer. I mean, he was a warrior. He killed a lot of people. He was sort of an on and off again king. He had this thing with Bathsheba, and killed her husband to have this illegitimate son. And but yet, his heart was seeking the face of God. And so it kind of tells me that you can take, people, sinful people like the rest of us, doing the best we can, but not doing so great sometimes, and God can love us and use us anyways.
Yeah, I think what's so cool about the Bible is we get the good, the bad, and the ugly truth. God's not giving us a sanitized version of, people's background. He's showing all of the failings, and he's simply using available people. He's not using perfect people. He's using ones that are in pursuit of him, not in perfection of their character and nature. That's God's job to transform and do that thing inside us.
And there's a lot of characters like that in the Bible. I mean, think about Moses and, he killed somebody and, all the different things. I mean, there's a lot of that.
Look, the conclusion I come to is I qualify. I think if we recognize that, then it's like, "Hey God, I got my hand raised. I'm looking at, I desire to pursue you. Would you help me?" And I think back to your question, about eyes to see, ears to hear, and a heart to respond. Ever since I came across that verse, I've made that my daily prayer, going like, "Hey God, if they wandered for 40 years and Moses was surprised, why did they not yet have that?" I'm going to at least make that as a request, saying, "God, please help me. Give me eyes to see, give me ears to hear, and a heart to respond. Don't let me be on my own trying to figure this out. Address me, search me, try me, see if there be any wicked way in me, and create a clean heart in me, O God." I think if we'll do that genuinely, and we recognize, "Hey, there's times, God, that because I've behaved poorly, I'm afraid to approach you, or I don't know what to do. Would you help change the way I see you and understand you so that I can do that better? Will you draw me to you?" I think most of us are trying really hard to please God, and I'm going like, I gave that up a while back. I'm going like, I think I kind of suck at that. I'm very intentional. I'm very smart. I work hard. But none of those things, apart from his spirit at work in me, is going to accomplish it. And so I'm really at a place where I'm going like, God, I don't want to be at odds with you. I don't want to chase after other things. I don't care how shiny they are. I don't care how enticing they are. If they're not good for me, please trip me. Please stop me. Please help me not be drawn to that. Let me taste you and pursue you. And if you'll show me the things that the guys in the Bible saw, I know I can do the things that they did. So would you engage me? And I ask him for that every day. I mean, every night I go to bed, I go like, hey, God, you got a few hours where my noisy brain will be out of the way. Would you please encounter me? Give me a dream. Speak to me. Put a thought in my heart that I can meditate on throughout the night. And then when I wake up, let me seek you. Let me present myself to you like, hey, I'm ready and available for service. What do you want to do today?
That's beautiful. You know, I don't think that all of us do that, or we do it a little bit, not consistently. And, you know, when you talked about that, the worst thing that happened in the Old Testament was losing the presence of God and asking for an earthly king. How does that relate to current times? How does that relate to us?
It's interesting. I think it's a core issue. I mean, I'll even bring it into our elections right now. You know, we're, as a people, we're going like, hey, this nation is not going in the right way. 87% of the people of this nation are going like, we don't like what we see. We don't like the direction we're going. We have zero trust in our leaders. We don't know if we're being lied to or hoodwinked. And so when we looked at this, we ended up going like, hey, God, things need to change. But here's one of the things that's a big problem. In the book of Judges, they never were released from their captivity until the people, the nation, really came to a place of repentance. You don't see them coming together to be a revolutionary force and let's overthrow, because when God puts you in judgment under another people and you're having to serve them because you've been, you know, chasing after their gods and stuff like that, you don't get released from your captivity until you repent. And yet, the nation of Israel, if we go to the time of Jesus, Jesus is coming as the king of the tribe of Judah. The people of Judah are going like, we don't want this guy to rule over us. They don't want Jesus. And so you have the triumphal entry, and the people are going, Hosanna, yeah, yeah. And you got the leaders going like, no, this is wrong. You should stop the people, rebuke them. And they're rejecting Jesus's coming as the king. And then they go through the whole bit of, they entrap him and they get him arrested. And then he's before Pilate. And then Pilate basically goes, I don't see anything wrong with this guy. And so he decided to offer them, you know, which the custom is, I'll release a prisoner to you. And it's like he had Barabbas, which was sort of a revolutionary assassin who wanted to overthrow Rome with violence. And his name is Barabbas, which is interesting because Barabbas means son of Abba. And then you have Jesus, who truly is the son of Abba. And that's how he called, you know, Papa. He called God Abba. That's the Jewish little name for, you know, the intimate term of Papa, something like that. And the Pharisees thought that's blasphemous. He's talking about God in a way that he shouldn't. It's like he's making it too familiar. And Pilate brings them before the people, and it's like, your choice. You want Barabbas or want Jesus? And Pilate's going like, I hope you pick Jesus, because my wife